Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. A reminder that you can subscribe to us on Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes, and if you like what you hear and you, well, you know, would like to leave a positive message, I am told that that actually counts. We have a return guest, Noah Rothman, who really needs no introduction, but I'll introduce him anyway. Associate editor of commentary, a fellow MSNBC contributor, and published author. What was your last book? It was The Social Justice Warriors, right?
First book and last book. So hopefully there will be another one along the lines. But yes, it was Unjust, Social Justice and the Unmaking of America.
Not your last book, just your most recent book.
Thank you.
Okay, there's a lot of things that I want to talk about, including AOC and my latest theory about AOC. But let's start with the president's reelection campaign rally, where he you know, a lot of the commentary is that he was just playing his greatest hits. We're going to be getting a lot more cowbell from Donald Trump. But this little soundbite jumped out at me when he lashed out at Democrats. And this is what he said.
Our radical Democrat opponents are driven by hatred, prejudice, and rage. They want to destroy you, and they want to destroy our country as we know it. Not acceptable. It's not going to happen.
Okay, Noah, you know what my first reaction to that was? You know, 4 years ago, when he was running for president, he sounded like a talk radio candidate. You know, the themes that you might get on Fox News or you know, the kind of show that I used to host. But last night, I realized he's gone full internet troll, that the Democrats are not just wrong on the issues. They hate you. They want to destroy you. And if you spend enough time on Twitter, you know that there is that sort of what has been kind of a subculture that the Democrats, must be stopped. Well, it's the whole Flight 93 election sort of thing, that it's not just an election between red and blue. It is us versus them. It is life versus death.
Yeah. So the difference, I suppose, from the 2016 era rallies is that this wasn't extemporaneous riffing. This was scripted. Somebody wrote that line and thought it was a really, you know, cogent assault on what the Democrats are trying to do and an articulation of the political imperatives that are facing Republicans and Republican voters, suggesting that this is really migrated from the hall of mirrors that is Twitter and into a much more mainstream political ethos. And it's particularly dangerous. You and I and others who are combating the populist impulse on the right and the left note that these are all constructs that the participants in this political dialogue have recreated for themselves that don't adhere to reality. It is the hyping up, the overhyping of a sense of danger and a sense of crisis in order to justify actions and behavior patterns that would otherwise be considered deeply antisocial and inimical to a Republican experience, you know, little our Republican sense of civic responsibility.
Yeah, there's the few historical parallels to that sort of thing as well, aren't there? So.
Yeah, of course. It's really common. I mean, this isn't something that we just invented here. I mean, I'd love to give ourselves that kind of credit, but no, unfortunately, these are really old impulses and pretty well studied. The nature of group psychology, mass psychology. This is what happens in movements that lose their organizing principle. And so they have to make one up for themselves in order to justify the social cohesion that generated the movement in the first place. It's not sustainable. I mean, it's the sort of thing that Elias Canetti wrote about. It's not a sustainable way to create and maintain a group cohesion, a crowd cohesion. But it is really effective initially. It can just have some very dangerous side effects.
Very dangerous side effects. And I don't know that we've seen the expiration date. You had a really clear vision, I think, of what this campaign is going to be like last night. And I'm really not sure that the Democrats have fully grasped what 2020 is going to be like. You can feel free to disagree with me about this. I mean, so the president's up there and he's, you know, obviously going to run on his record, you know, peace and, you know, safety, security, the economy. But the real heart of this message is the reverse side, is that the other side is dangerous. They're going to destroy the economy. They are for open borders. They have all these crazy radical ideas out there. And the Democrats are out, convincing themselves that they need to come up with many many, many, many policy points. I think that Amy Klobuchar came up with, what, 167 or something? It was 130, so I don't know what it was. New policy proposals, and every other day, Elizabeth Warren comes up with a new plan. What I think that Trump understands is that this election is going to be decided by sort of that big, visceral feeling, that tribal loyalty, that just sort of the gut sense, as opposed to the minutiae of policy. Do you follow what I'm getting at here?
Yeah, of course. I mean, every election is decided on those lines, or at least a national presidential election, right? People don't. That's not how voters think. I mean, especially swing voters, and they're not. Swing voters are not ideological people. They don't pursue. They don't have ideological goals. Otherwise, they would be committed voters in one party or another. They see things in much more of a macro sense. They have a sentimental attachment to certain views and values and people, and they vote for people. They don't necessarily vote for policies. So
or
yeah,
they vote against people.
I mean, right.
I think that the Trump understands that he's not going to expand his base. He's going to, you know, obviously do everything possible to maximize the turnout of his base. And I think I said this on Hardball last night. You were on Hardball too, Hardball as well. So maybe, but he doesn't need to win the election. He needs to make the Democrats lose it. He doesn't need people to necessarily to like him. He needs them to really hate the opponent and decide that, okay, we know all these horrible things that Donald Trump has done. We're really sick of him. But at least we know what the problem is here. On the other hand, and I think you wrote about this a couple of months ago, the Democrats have spent their time in the wilderness coming up with all sorts of proposals that almost seem like they were baked up in a laboratory to offend and to disillusion the swing voter, you know, whether it's basic income or, you know, the nationalized health care, which I don't think they fully understand is not a political winner.
No, they don't. So there was this phenomenon in 2011, 2012, I suppose, maybe 2010, too, in which the Democratic commentary, the liberal commentary convinced itself that its opponents, that Republicans had cloistered themselves intellectually in such a way that they had no feel or understanding for the general ethos of the American civic compact and what Americans really wanted from their political system. And they coined it epistemic closure. And they seem unable to recognize it in themselves, because that's precisely what has happened. The Democrats spent the years in the wilderness coming up with a lot of progressive policy proposals that have blown up on the tarmac the minute they've been subjected to even the most mildest scrutiny from a skeptical population of American voters or American political observers. And you mentioned Medicare for All, which is perhaps the best example of it. It was only one that I used in that pretty long feature. It's called Democrats Go Mad. The example of that is the extent to which so many Democrats, many of whom are running for president, co-sponsored Bernie Sanders' bill for a Medicare for All, which very explicitly all but nationalizes the health insurance industry. It makes health insurance provision for employers illegal. It allows for supplemental insurance, but leaves them with a risk pool too small to sustain that alternative model. So it essentially nationalizes healthcare. And the minute that Kamala Harris was asked about this and said, yeah, that's what we're going to do, there was a big outcry. And all of a sudden, all these Democrats, including co-sponsors of this bill, said, wait a minute, that's a terrible idea, as though they didn't know that's exactly what they had signed on to. But of course, they all knew. They just didn't know how unpopular it was, or they didn't fully grasp how unpopular it was, because they're not talking to anyone else besides the people with whom they already agree.
Yeah, this is really a good point. And I think there was a survey, just a poll yesterday from the Kaiser Family Foundation, that found that people just really had no idea what the term Medicare for All meant. And even Democrats thought that under Medicare for All, you'd be able to keep your own private insurance plan. Although under Bernie's, you wouldn't be able to. So your analogy of, you know, how it blows up on the tarmac, they're testing it on, you know, I mean, look, it plays well on the Chris Hayes show. But when you get into a general election, you can certainly imagine what $200 million of Republican money is going to do about, you know, this is the plan to do this to the economy, to do this to the free market, to do this to your health care. And if we've learned one thing It's that if you tell people, we're going to mess with your health care, we're going to take away the health care you want, and we're going to try a completely untested new federalized system, that is not going to end well. And you're right. I don't sense that, because Democrats have been talking to one another, that they understand what that's going to look like when it's, you know, battle tested next fall.
Well, credit to Bernie, at least, that he knows that a Medicare for all system necessitates the elimination of a private model. You cannot have the two models existing side by side. You can't have a buy-in, for example, to Medicare, which is now something that some are toying with, and also a private model, because the Medicare model becomes overstressed very quickly and becomes unsustainable. I mean, there's anybody who's familiar with the contours of the policy knows that, but politics doesn't necessarily, you know, reward people who are honest about this sort of thing. So I anticipate that they will campaign on the "you can have everything and pay nothing for it" model. But as you say, I mean, when the party that seeks to reform healthcare is the party that tends to lose. It's just that you have to get around to actually reforming it. So it doesn't necessarily mean that that's an obstacle to winning an election. It means it's an obstacle to actually getting legislation passed.
Yeah, and I also think this, by the way, applies to many of Elizabeth Warren's big plans that she has, because I can really envision next year, if she were to get the nomination, the way that the Trump and the Republicans would make, you know, her plan for you feel very, very different than it is. Now, you had a very, very interesting piece, I thought, about Bernie Sanders' big speech. Bernie Sanders was supposedly going to give this full-throated endorsement of socialism. And instead, and I think your piece was really insightful, Bernie kind of whiffed on it, didn't he? He wanted to use the word socialism, but he wanted to try to normalize it, didn't he?
This is a gripe that I've had, which is just about linguistic cowardice. He went out there seeking essentially to reshape the definition of what constitutes socialism. And he did so, as you say, in a way to advocate for it. But at the same time, what he spent just about all his attention on was saying how all of these programs and proposals that he has endorsed really aren't socialism. And the only people who are attacking them as socialism are doing so disingenuously or dishonestly, or maybe even just ignorantly. And there's something to that, because what Bernie Sanders didn't advocate for was socialism, as we understand it, the dictionary definition, the assumption of the means of production by the state and the direction of resources, irrespective of market signals. That's socialism. And that's what Bernie Sanders believes, by the way. He's not renounced his views. He has not renounced his belief that we should nationalize certain industries, or that we should turn the post office into a bank, or a variety of other proposals that he thinks that really do constitute a socialistic model of economic and social structures. But he hasn't been able to go out and say that, which is very heartening, I think, for opponents of a socialistic system, that its chief advocate in the American political system can't bring himself to really advocate for it.
This is where you're not just another pretty face, Noah, because yes, what Bernie, you cut through Bernie Sanders' speech, it really is an acknowledgement that the term socialism is still toxic, that it still carries that stink. So somehow he needs to try to dress it up and make it seem very, very benign.
Republicans get you know, wrapped around the shoulders for being so hidebound and attached to the 1980s and economic philosophies of Art Laffer. But Bernie Sanders spent the entirety of his speech hearkening back to the glory days of the 1930s. So at least the Republicans have a good 70 years on them.
Yes, I will bring back Franklin Delano Roosevelt. You know, I was when I was talking about, when we were talking before about the Democrats and the way they may alienate, and I'm going to make a pivot here, you know, may alienate swing voters with ideas like socialism, because this country is not ready for socialism. And I think that at some level, Bernie Sanders' speech made that very, very clear. But, you know, even more than that, talking with Democrats who are still in this in the epistemic closure, I don't think they understand how the other cultural issues and, you know, so the social justice issues that you wrote about in your book, how that also plays out, that we really are moving just simply past economic issues. Economic issues are, of course, very, very important. But there is that sort of us versus them, that sense of the hectoring, the bullying, the demands for conformity that really, I think, you know, at the back of a lot of, you know, a lot of the division. And one of the things that I hear a lot from Democrats and people on the left is that, well, these stories that you're talking about are just anecdotes. Okay, you had this problem with a bakery that didn't want to bake a cake. Or, okay, you have this problem with Oberlin with this one isolated incident. Or, you know, this one story of somebody who was treated badly. But what I think they don't understand is that those anecdotes are stories and their narratives that really explain the division in society, and that those are more powerful. Those stories are more powerful than Elizabeth Warren's flowcharts.
Oh, by far. And I, as I wrote in that book, I mean, Democrats spent the better part of two decades creating a marketplace for victimization, creating capital around the assumption of being victimized, and creating a set of social rewards for victimization, some of which are very due and valuable and that we shouldn't disparage. But at the same time, when you reward a behavior pattern, you're gonna get more of it. And so you've now seen, in a way that I think is very unhealthy, the Republican side of the ledger looking for, assuming, and ascribing to themselves a sense of victimization at the hands of societal, you know, institutions, be it higher education or the entertainment complex or what have you, all of which are arrayed against them. And that's a very powerful organizing principle. It's psychologically deleterious. It doesn't do anything for you as far as giving yourself a sense of agency and allowing you to navigate the environment in which you live. I mean, it creates a sense. It literally gives people the opportunity to sell you on something, which we've seen manifest in the form of woke brands that are now assuming this sort of, you know, the ideological cultural war themes, not politics per se, but sort of semi-political themes, and adopting values for themselves and appealing to consumers with those values as well as their product, but perhaps even more so with those values. And that's, again, these are companies trying to pitch you on some things. And I don't think that this is a healthy form of how politics should be engaged, but it's also one that Democrats are created and incubated. And now if Republicans are beating them at their own game, you know, perhaps they should take a critical look at the path they set for themselves.
Well, two things about that. Number one, it's also a culture of contempt, that a lot of people feel that they are disrespected, that in fact the left is not listening to them and regards them as a bunch of Neanderthal racists. And I think that that's very, very off-putting. But also, and then the flip side you mentioned is how central this playing of the victim card now has become on the right, on the Trumpist right. And, you know, in part it is to kind of weaponize that sense that they hate you, they don't like you. And, you know, what's interesting, I mean, there are some sort of Twitter trolls out there whose theme is constantly that liberals hate you, they want to destroy you. And the president now is articulating that. And that gives you license, of course, to be as aggressive, to shatter norms, to disrespect and hold your enemies in contempt as well.
At root, I don't think it's true, right? Well, I mean, no. I don't think any of that is actually true. I don't think that, there are certainly actors on both sides of the political aisle who regard their political adversaries as existential threats, as subhumans to whom you can do whatever you want. And that sort of, construct is reinforced in places like Twitter, which really accentuates, encourages hyperbole, discourages nuance, and rewards the radicalization of debate. I do think that there's some substance to that, but that's the definition of an anecdote, right? That doesn't necessarily mean that it's a macro phenomenon. And also, it's just, even if it were, it's not the place of the president to say as much, because it's dangerous. It is an assault on national comedy. And the president's job, albeit an unstated one, is to heighten, national cohesion, social cohesion, and to do as much as they can to ensure that those social bonds are preserved. This president views his role very differently.
Yeah, not this president. But people ought to recognize what Trump is doing. And again, don't underestimate some of the tactics. So what he's done rather effectively is to take attacks on him, and you could see it at the rally. With the attacks on him, he turns around and says, these are attacks on you. When they say these things about me, they're really saying these things about you. And that's why the whole Hillary Clinton deplorable thing, you know, had this outsized impact. Because what Trump could say is, okay, when they show contempt for my behavior and everything, what they're really saying is that you people are deplorables. And it's really very, very effective.
Barack Obama and his allies did the exact same thing.
They
and
did.
In a way, they did, when they appealed to race in doing so. Everyone from the president on down to Eric Holder to his supporters in media took every slight and insult as an opportunity to question racial attitudes, be they latent or otherwise, in the president's critics. And while I think that actually had the perverse effect of desensitizing the Republican electorate to genuine racism, which the president certainly used to his effect,
that's
positive effect. It was also extremely cynical, and the exact same tactic in a funhouse mirror that the sophisticates in media and academia don't recognize as such because they simply agree with it. But it's the same thing.
I think you're right about that. Okay, let's switch to AOC, who's back in the news again. Now, if you had to, by the way, create a template for the reelection of Donald Trump, item number one would be, let's talk about AOC a lot more and make her the face of the Democratic Party. Very specifically, though, she did a video where she talks about our fascist president creating concentration camps on the border with the migrants, used the phrase never forget. This caused immediate backlash, people saying, look, are you really using Holocaust imagery? And of course, a lot of her media allies immediately came to her defense saying, well, no, concentration camp doesn't mean death camp. Maybe she was talking about the Boer War. So where are we at on this? What is your take on AOC's invocation of concentration camps?
In any other 29-year-old, this kind of deplorable hyperbole and emotional reasoning would be dismissible, if not excusable. It's less excusable, certainly in a congresswoman. But in a saner political culture, we would attribute this to youthful inexperience and educational deficiencies and just simple zeal for the cause, and dismiss her and make a more cogent case for what really is a humanitarian crisis on the border necessitating real legislation and not just the kind of thing that we've seen passed today in the Senate, a $4.6 billion deal aimed at mitigating humanitarian conditions on the border, but also addressing the Flores settlement and a variety of other conditions that have allowed for this to metastasize over the course of, and more judges, you know, this has been building for two decades. That is, of course, not what happens, because American politics has devolved into a raw contest of personalities. And so if you were to throw Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez under the bus, which is certainly the prudent thing to do to make way for more rational voices, it would be to give Republicans a victory and to validate their concerns and to validate the attacks on her. So there has been this mass rally to her defense from people in media and academia and in the press. Republicans have pounced, of course. Now we've gone into this weird debate about how concentration camps, as you say, originate from the Boer War. And so even though she used the phrase never again, maybe she's talking about British camps in South Africa. I mean, all of it is just simply nonsensical. It doesn't even register. It doesn't pass even the simplest smell test for somebody who's not invested in outcomes, in political outcomes. And so this is the sort of thing that you have to think, like, why would you invest this kind of labor into defending these indefensible statements? I mean, I don't want to be laboriously bipartisan here, but Republicans know this very well, because Donald Trump compels his supporters to go to the mattresses more, especially for the statements that he makes that have absolutely no basis in fact and are utterly indefensible. Those are the ones that are most especially necessitate some kind of an intervention on their part, and a really zealous one too, because it demonstrates you're down for the cause or what have you. But it's a real diminishing returns situation, because I don't see what they're getting out of it. What they're essentially saying here is that what even by AOC's own definition, which is that, and the academic definition here, which is weird, that concentration camps constitute the detention of individuals indefinitely without trial. It doesn't pass muster here. That's not what goes on here. These are the detention of migrants, not in lieu of trial, but in preparation for trial. Many of them are when they're seen by a judge, they're then released and said, you know, okay, come back for your next hearing. And many of them do. Most of them do, in fact. But that doesn't constitute a concentration camp by her own definition. So you would think that she would be just dismissed.
Yeah,
but psychological impulse is to rally behind her.
Yeah, but also the emotional impulse, which is that the scenes from the border are distasteful. I mean, the separation of children, the report we had this week of a 4-month-old baby who was separated, and you do have these pictures of looks like people in cages. And of course, there then is the emotional impulse that if I don't like what I'm seeing here, I have to make it into Hitler and the Holocaust. I have to, you know, wipe out those particular distinctions. And of course, this has been happening for some time. In the time that we have left, I want to get your take on what's going on with Iran, it's really hard to tell what degree to which this, in fact, is escalating. The president apparently is sending another 1,000 troops to the Middle East. He's reportedly very, very reluctant to engage in any sort of, preemptive attack on Iran. But again, so where are we with all of that? Are we going to war with Iran? And is this escalation worth it?
Well, look, if Donald Trump doesn't have very many ideological convictions, but he does have some, among them being his support for protectionism, trade protectionism, and another being his distaste for foreign military engagements. That has been consistent throughout his political career, dating back decades. From everything we know about this president, that obtains to the situation in Iran. And so the president has responded very reluctantly and very passively, I would say, to what constitutes real aggressive escalating provocations on the part of Iran. And according to the president's detractors, his move of several assets, air assets, and a few thousand troops into the region in early May on the word of intelligence officials who had credible information that attacks were forthcoming constituted a buildup for an invasion of Iran, which is simply ignorant. That's a deterrent force that is not an invasion force for Persia, for anybody who understands what that would constitute. But that doesn't matter. The facts were not relevant to the people who believed that this is a warmongering president. When there was an attack, an assault on 4 ships, sophisticated below the water effort to disable these ships, including 2 Saudi oil tankers in the UAE, anchored in the UAE. That too was evidence that the Trump administration was desperate to go to war. And that casus belli, which was very much a casus belli, was not responded to. A month later, we had another event, a much more sophisticated attack using limpet mines, and the administration produced video, photographic evidence, and a detailed timeline of events. And all of this constitutes, in the minds of the president's detractors, even members of Congress, as an effort by the president to provoke Iran into war. Precisely the opposite. The president has responded so lethargically to an escalating pattern of provocations that I think it's probably negligent at this point. The administration is telling everybody willing to listen that it's Iran wants to provoke a limited military response in order to create social cohesion that has deteriorated as these really serious sanctions on metal industries and industries targeting the blue collar workers in Iran that are really integral to the coherent to the regime, the stability of the regime, that they want to provoke something, a set of pinprick strikes that would constitute an overreaction around which the Iranian regime can rally. And the administration doesn't want to give them that, to their credit. I think that's a good, smart strategy on their part, because a war would be very difficult. But you don't see any of that sort of rationality on the part of the president's critics. They've not taken the events are sort of circumstantial or incidental. It is their belief that Donald Trump is, you know, the worst possible president and has the worst possible designs and motives, and so they describe him bad faith in every and all action. But that's conspiratorial thinking. I mean, that it's not rational. It's not linked to any sort of empirical evidence. But it's nevertheless, it's very popular among people who we would otherwise think are pretty rational actors, really, you know, high ranking members of the political system. And it's very discouraging to see that kind of conspiratorial thinking prevail.
And you have written about this, but the flip side of this is that you know, and I wrote this the other day. I said it's very clear that Iran is behind these attacks, but the administration has this credibility problem, which reminds us why it is a bad idea for presidents to routinely lie about inconsequential bullshit, because sooner or later you're going to want that credibility back. And so, you know, unfortunately, you know, that the administration has so squandered its credibility, has lied about so many things, that now that we're faced with a potential real crisis, they find that, well, the well is dry. So, yes, there's no question about it. I mean, some of the criticism, I think, has been quite irresponsible. On the other hand, you know, when you have someone like Donald Trump, who has, you know, undermined the norms of his office, what a surprise that the nation does not look to him as a wartime commander-in-chief.
Yeah, there's a lot to that. But on the other hand, I don't see the president's critics citing the president's mendacity or his, strained relationship with the truth when they justify this conspiracy theory. They cite the Gulf of Tonkin incident. They cite the run up to the Iraq War. They cite formative experiences from the decades past, and in some cases, even their childhoods, in order to justify what they believe is a reason, rational cynicism here, but it's cynicism masquerading as wisdom. It is, again, it is not tethered to any sort of empirical evidence that you can cite in this instance, in this administration, in this unique set of circumstances. It's circumstances from decades past. And it's in many ways a lot like the Kavanaugh hearings, where we saw people consult their pasts and their own personal experiences in order to fill in the blanks and reach a conclusion that they had already been predetermined to make. That's a psychological set of conditions that you set for yourself, but it's not moored to any sort of rational, logical approach to events. So no, I don't find that to be a compelling argument against this administration, especially since the administration is telling anybody willing to listen again that they're not trying to get into a war here, that a war would derail their strategy.
No, not necessarily, but perhaps it is an explanation that you know, you do have, you know, a long history of administrations that have been less than candid when it comes to issues like this. But in this particular case, this is a president who has not enhanced his own credibility. So I take your point, but again, you know, in order to take a nation to war, you not only have to have the facts, you not only have to have the policy, but you do have to have certain psychological conditions of trust that do not obtain right now. Okay, so do you want to weigh in on Kyle Kashuv at all? Because I think you are the last pundit on earth who has not had an opinion on it.
Yeah, it's bad punditry, I suppose, to say that I'm of two minds on the situation. I don't have a really fully formed opinion. I sympathize greatly with those who say that this is really a dangerous new phenomenon where, you know, this is an individual who made a mistake as a teenager, owned up to it, apologized for it, and nevertheless is suffering consequences for it. At the same time, I understand why those consequences are being meted out. I think they're probably disproportionate to the nature of the offense, but it is not my decision to make. This is a private institution that can do what it wants. And so I'm of many minds on that situation. I also think that it's really inappropriate and dangerous and frankly counterproductive to marshal children into the culture war.
Right. I think that's the heart of it.
Both political parties are engaged in that. Children are provided special dispensation in the political discourse. We allow them to opine on issues. We give them a platform to opine on issues, but they're immune in many ways from the kind of scrutiny that adults would face when engaging in those political issues. And so it's incumbent on us to take them with a grain of salt and limit their exposure to the political environment. And when we don't do that, we abdicate our responsibility as adults and perform great injury on these children and also do no service to the political discourse. So I'm generally predisposed to say children should not be given a giant microphone. And when they do, bad things happen and it backfires on the movement that embraced them.
I completely agree with you all that. I mean, this fundamental error of making children these avatars of any political cause and pretending that, you know, their youth and their sincerity, you know, imbues them with, you know, wisdom, insight, or, you know, other qualities that are usually associated with maturity. And so when you push and give both sides of the Parkland, you know, kids of the massacre, when you push them forward, you know, it's not only a bad idea, it's unfair because it catapults them beyond their competency and it puts them in a spotlight that can be pretty ugly. And in the case of Kyle Kashev, and I should have introduced this better. I mean, he's the, you know, very, very pro gun rights, pro life, conservative heartthrob, who in a lot of ways was thrust into celebrity in reaction to the way the media was glorifying the anti-gun activist from Parkland. You know, he's sort of the anti-David Hogg. But here you have this kid who's now, you know, being, you know, kind of like the Justin Bieber of the, you know, Trumpist right. He's meeting with the president of the United States in the Oval Office, the vice president in his office. He's, you know, he's on Fox News. He's, you know, featured by the NRA. He's hanging around with Charlie Kirk and Candace Owens. And then it turns out that a couple of years ago, he's posting things using the N-word, including the phrase, you know, kill all the Jews. Now, see, this is where it becomes complicated because, you know, you and I would agree that we do not want to be judged by the dumbest thing we did when we were 16. But when you are 17 or 18, you are going to be judged by what you did when you were 16. And there's no statute of limitations for a college to say, we're not going to look at what you did in high school. In fact, that's the entire way colleges decide what they're going to do. They want to know, what did you do in high school? They're not going to turn a blind eye to that sort of thing. And I do think in this particular case, you know, we can sort of imagine many of the conservatives who are rushing to Kyle Kashev's defense. If it was David Hogg who was saying kill all the Jews and making anti-Semitic or anti-gay slurs or using the N-word, I don't think that they would be defending his free speech rights. I don't think that they would be taking the position that they're taking. As you mentioned before, it's just sort of like what side you're on. But I feel bad about it because of his age, because of the, you know, the fact that he was exploited in a certain way, put into a position that we never should have put him into. He's going to be fine. But you know, my whole career has been beating up on higher education in places like Harvard. So I can't believe I'm saying that I think Harvard made the right choice, because I couldn't imagine them making the other choice. I just don't know how, when they have rescinded the admissions of other people who had been engaged in racist and anti-Semitic stuff, how you have a guy who does the N-word, you know, talks about, you know, end jocks and kill all the Jews. I just don't know how they justify admitting him to Harvard.
Yeah, so I'll give conservatives, I guess, some other examples as to why this is a really dangerous impulse. Children are being conscripted into the debate over climate change to an obscene degree. They are the plaintiffs in lawsuits against states and fossil fuel companies. They are besieging Dianne Feinstein's office, and the young 16-year-old Greta Thunberg has become a very famous personality, Swedish girl, who is now, you know, organizing these child walkouts and clogging the streets of Europe and trying to, you know, shut down commerce in order to generate, you know, interest in the climate change debate. She speaks from the panel of the United Nations Climate Change Conference. She's addressed the British Parliament. She castigates adults from these podiums and is, you know, praised for it. But she's probably a disturbed person physically. She has been diagnosed with Asperger's. She has OCD. She is engaged in selective mutism and self-starvation. And she has said that it's the climate change that is creating these crippling psychological deficiencies in her. And her parents have viewed this as something like a superpower. It is helping her to navigate her environment. And so they have thrust her into the political debate in a way that is probably very unhealthy. Similarly, you know, have what has overtaken the more cultural right, the condition of Desmond Maples, who's the 11-year-old drag kid. There's a young boy who dresses in drag and performs what is sort of like a mock striptease, where he is essentially the subject of sexual objectification as an 11-year-old child. Now, her parents say that his advocacy work in support of LGBT issues is his, quote, main mission. But no child can make that determination for themselves. No child can determine, even if his gender identity is his own condition and his own choice to share it with the world, it is not his choice to engage in this kind of political activism. That's not something a child chooses. They don't have access to those platforms unless adults open them for them, marshal them into them, because they find them to be valuable voices. And no conservative, I think, would find that to be a healthy form of discourse for a child. But they find it to be healthy because somebody advocates for gun rights. Those two things do not compute.
No, it is deeply cynical, I think, to co-opt these children to advance this political cause, use them as kind of the human shields. And hopefully we will learn our lesson from this, but of course we won't. Noah Rothman, thanks so much for joining us again on the podcast. I appreciate it very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.